The next case on calendar this morning is Gonzalez Alpizar versus Griffith, case number 59387. Mr. Cornell.
Thank you very much. If it pleases the court and counsel, my name is Richard Cornell. I represent the appellant, Gabriela Gonzalez Alpizar. This, of the numerous family cases I've handled over the years, I don't know that I've ever had one that I felt more strongly about, factually. But I realize that this court, having set this case in bank, isn't necessarily concerned with that. In looking at this case and asking what is the issue that concerns the court and bank, I think it's this. If the Costa Rican support order cannot be enforced per NRS 130.035, because the Secretary of State has not recognized Costa Rica as a state, is there any other basis to enforce it? My answer to that question is as follows. At a minimum, the order can be enforced per NRS 125B.140 or 125.180, but I think it also can be enforced under Chapter 130, under 130.10179, sub 2. The difference, of course, is this. As to arrearages, it doesn't matter. As to prospective support, if it's enforced under 125B or 125, the payor can come into court and assert change circumstances to lower the support order prospectively. If it's under 130, he's got to do that in the court, the state, if you will, that issued the order. In this case, Costa Rica, and we have a respondent who has no intent to go to Costa Rica to do that.
Wasn't there an issue as to the specificity of the support order?
In my opinion, I don't see how there could be. And I am going to talk about that in some length, but to answer your question right now, the order is very clear in what it says. $235 per month per child, so $470 in child support and $180 a month in alimony or spousal support, so $650 per month total. I think the order is crystal clear on that. There is an issue, of course, and I will talk about it, as to whether the subsequent order that creates an automatic increase because of the weakness of the Costa Rican colon versus the U.S. dollar, whether that order can be enforced. And I'll talk about that in a second. I submit to you that even under 125B, 140, 125, 180, this order can be enforced for four reasons. First, Costa Rica had in personam jurisdiction over the respondent because the respondent was personally served with process in Costa Rica, and the respondent chose not to appear. Trial judge made a finding of fact on that. That finding was supported by substantial evidence. Indeed, it's supported by overwhelming evidence. It's not only supported by the testimony of my client and her attorney when we flew up here from Costa Rica to testify, and it's not only supported by the affidavit of service by the court services officer in Costa Rica. We all know undisputedly that the respondent took the papers once it was put in his hand and threw them on the ground and left the office, left Costa Rica, and never returned. Why would he do that unless he knew he was being served with process that he didn't want to meet? Now, secondly, the respondent in this case, after having the order go through, has done nothing, as in nothing, to attempt to set that order aside in 7+ years. If we were here a year from now, it would be 8+ years. As a matter of Nevada law, I submit to you, that order is res judicata as to him in terms of any defenses that he could have asserted in Costa Rica had he chose to stay and fight it. And I say that because, number three, there's no evidence that my client pulled a fraud on the court or a fraud on him, i.e. extrinsic fraud. There's no evidence that this man was denied his day in court in Costa Rica. He chose not to have his day in court in Costa Rica. What he is complaining about now, 7 years after the fact, can be labeled as intrinsic fraud. In other words, you presented evidence that wasn't complete and wasn't accurate and shaded the facts too much your way, that sort of thing. Well, this is why we have trials. Show up and present your evidence and convince the judge that the other side isn't entitled to what they think they're entitled to. And that leads to my fourth issue. Based on the circumstances of 2005, when this order was entered, An award of $650 family support is very consistent with what Nevada public policy is and what a Nevada court would do under like circumstances. I laid that out in opening brief pages 20 through 22. With respect to Anthony, the child who was born during the union, based on the respondent's income under 125B070, he would be on the hook for $500 a month just for that child. What about Nicole, the second child? Mr. Griffith signed recognition papers before he moved the family from Costa Rica to Nevada. Under Costa Rican law, that is the same as an adoption. He actually supported the child when they lived together here in Nevada as a family, and he claimed that child on his tax returns for 4 years after that. Under those circumstances, Fry v. Fry, I think, would be the controlling case from this court. It would be consistent with Nevada policy to make him pay support for that child. Those figures would get you to $700 a month based on his income in 2005 before we even get to alimony. So the $650 per month is not at all offensive under Nevada law, I would suggest to you. But as I said, this order, I think, can be enforced under 130.10179 sub 2. That is the conclusion that I would urge the court to reach, which the court can reach if it finds that Costa Rica and Nevada law are substantially similar. They certainly are substantially similar in that child support orders in both jurisdictions are based on the secondary custodial or payor spouse's income, which would be the case here and is the case in Costa Rica. It's based on his ability to pay, and it's payable in monthly stipend. What are the differences? Well, as I see it, there are two. Number one, one difference is that there is a different age of emancipation in Nevada versus Costa Rica. It's quite a bit longer in Costa Rica. I would submit that I don't have a problem with that because the Minnesota Court of Appeals didn't have a problem with that, and the Hennepin County
was as well. In Judge Harley's final conclusions in the decree that was dated, I don't have the date, but at number six, the court will not enforce the first decree provisions, but then it goes on to talk about the subsequent or the child support enforcement order because he's not sure as to the extent and enforceability. So he's indicating that what was presented to him before that court, he didn't have a sufficient basis to say whether or not it was extinct or that it should be enforced going forward, as you're asserting.
Right.
So we had that finding by the district court. Why should we disavow that?
I'll tell you why. We went to the trouble of having official Costa Rican certified translations of the order as well as the original as trial exhibits. Not only that, we had the trial lawyer on the divorce, Mr. Monge Corrales, come up and testify. He testified to those documents. On their face, they're valid, extant, and enforceable. There's no evidence to suggest that they're not. I don't quite frankly understand where Judge Hardy's coming from in that. What else were we supposed to do? We have certified copies, we have certified translations of the certified copies, and we have a lawyer explaining it to the judge, and on its face, it's very clear. $650 a month until this child reaches the age of majority, which can go all the way through college under their law, under Costa Rican law. I think it's clear as a bell. Now, the second issue that's different does bother me, to be frank with you, and that is the business of the automatic increase in the order based on the weakness of the cologne. I would grant you that there is no provision in Nevada law or any other law in the United States that would recognize that or enforce that as a matter of state law within the 50 states in the United States. But that order came later. It wasn't in the body of this $650 a month order. That order came later. And quite frankly, if the court were inclined to enforce the order, say, and accept that, I wouldn't be bothered by that. I'm not saying I concede it. I'm saying I wouldn't be bothered by that. I could understand that thinking for that reason. Now,
Mr. Cordell, I wonder if you could, before you move on to the next part of your argument, if, unless I've interrupted you at a wrong point.
No, you're interrupting me.
The first part of your analysis, that the order can be sustained under 125B140 or 125180, seems to fly in the face of the express provisions of Chapter 140. Here we have a foreign government support order. The statute was specifically enacted to address the circumstances under which foreign government support orders, especially in the context of alimony or child support, are going to be recognized. And you're tendering an analysis which would seem to disregard or ignore that statute. I know that you just made the point that you'd like to have the orders sustained at least in part, except for the valuation difference under the Cologne, under 130.10, whatever it is, subparagraph 2. But your first argument that you made, that it can be done without regard to that statute, I don't understand how we get there.
First off, I don't see where 130 supersedes 125B or 125.180. If it did, I would think that that whole statute would just be eliminated.
What is the point of the legislature in adopting the uniform foreign judgment statute? I don't understand. If they adopted that statute, it specifically covers these kinds of circumstances. It delegates to the Attorney General the ability to recognize certain countries. Then why wouldn't the court begin and potentially end its analysis on that statute?
Because by virtue of the second statute, the 10179 sub 2, UIFSA seemed to recognize that there would be circumstances where a certain foreign country wouldn't be recognized by the Secretary of State as a state for reasons that don't really make sense or don't compute. And in those cases, we ought to be able, under that statute, to take a look and say, well, is the law of that country similar to this law? I pointed out in the reply brief the Wilmer case out of California where that very thing was done relative to West Germany, and that order was enforced accordingly.
But again, the analysis is occurring under the recognized exception or condition under that. My concern is your suggestion is that we not even address the issue under 130, but rather address the issue under 125B140 or 125180.
Well, I'm being thorough and careful. 125B is my fallback position, and as I indicated in the reply brief, when you have a case where somebody is personally served with process, i.e., that foreign jurisdiction has impersonal jurisdiction over the person, and they leave, we recognize those orders as a matter of comity. And I think because of that, that gets us and shoehorns us at least into 125B. That's my position. Mm-hmm. Now,
Mr. Cornell, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
If I may make, let me go into the prenup, if I may, quickly, and if that blows my time, that blows my time, if I may. Mm-hmm. That gets us to $470 a month. What about the other $180 for alimony? If the prenup in this case is invalid, this is an alimony case, Cruett versus Osborne, there's such a huge disparity between the respondent and my client, who's a peasant woman who makes $200 per month, that can't be any other way. And my question is, how can you uphold a prenup under these circumstances? A, it's written in English at a time when my client couldn't read English. B, it's not translated word for word to my client, and that's undisputed. C, it's only partially explained, and that's undisputed. D, it's done the day before the wedding. I mean, yes, it was the judge found, as a matter of fact, that it was faxed weeks before, but so what? It's a meaningless document until it's interpreted or explained. That happens the day before the wedding. My client had no bargaining power. The respondent made it clear there would be no wedding unless and until she signed this agreement. And the waiver of alimony, as well as community property, and the fact that she would have no interest in community property unless her name was actually on the document or title, none of that was ever explained. The interpreter, if you will, who was really the marriage officiant, who had an interest in getting this wedding done so she could get paid, obviously, says, there's nothing in this document that can hurt you, to which I say, really? No alimony? Anyway, the cases in the brief, I think, well cite why that agreement is invalid under those circumstances and can't be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Beth Luna. I represent the respondent, Ed Griffith, in this case. I think at the end of the day, this case really is about civil rights in the state and protecting our citizens from foreign court orders. It is also about whether or not prenuptial agreements should be enforced when parties create them. I'm going to start in the same way that Mr. Cornell did, since that seems to be the big issue with the enforcement of the Costa Rica court order. I'd just like to touch on a couple of things. There are two orders from down there. The first, the lower court found, was served appropriately. We disagree with that finding, and we believe that a review of the facts and evidence in that case will show that conclusion of law to be incorrect. The reason is, when you look at the evidence, there are differing stories as to how that service occurred. Case law from Hilton v. Goyette makes clear there must be comity, there must be actual notice when it comes to service. My client on the first was served in Spanish in the office of his wife's then attorney. He did not understand what was being said to him. The facts in the case show only two consistent stories and how that was served, and that is Ms. Alpizar and Mr. Griffith both recall no one translating it. Although others...
The same argument that the counsel is indicating requires that the prenup be invalidated?
I think it is, Your Honor, but there's a difference between the prenup and this. The prenuptial agreement was sent to her in July. She had family members around her that could understand English and Spanish, including the couple that introduced the parties and interpreted for them. She was also given the independent counsel at the time of signing who was able to interpret it as well. This, on the service of the first support order, didn't occur for my client.
But didn't he have somebody available that could have interpreted had he chosen or wished?
Not at the time that it was served, and he did not leave the office.
He couldn't say, wait, I need to have somebody read this to me?
Well, Your Honor, they read it to him in Spanish, and I guess the process there is that the process server reads it aloud, and it was read aloud in Spanish. I think that the law is very clear that you have to have actual notice that a response is needed and that you need to appear to defend yourself. And in my first appeal, my client didn't have that notice. Not only that, there is extrinsic fraud in both those cases. In both cases, she didn't provide an address. So in the first case, when the order actually came through, my client didn't know about it for a year later. And that order actually gave him 3 days to disagree with it. Now, unfortunately, a year later, that 3 days had run because she didn't provide an address where my client could have gotten that order. He got the order from Child Support Enforcement here. The second case, in the same way, the lower court found that it was not appropriately served, and in part because there was an issue with Mr. Gonzalez, her attorney, and Mrs. Alpizar both not providing an address when they knew full well where he resided. She was getting child support checks. She was getting packages. She just didn't provide an appropriate address, and so they ended up doing it by publication. He was on no notice.
Counsel, let's go back. You said she was getting child support checks?
She was, Your Honor.
So then didn't he acknowledge them prior?
No, sir. He was actually sending her support checks even after and before the parties filed for divorce. He was sending packages.
Not dealing with the divorce order. I don't even
know. Right.
Dealing with the first order. And you're saying he was sending support for the child to her.
Was he acknowledging
the previous order by doing that?
Well, I would not necessarily say so because he was doing it even prior to that. He was sending support for the family unbeknownst to him that there was even an order out there. The amount he was sending was also not the same amount that was ordered. He simply sent those checks, and he continues to do that today to send items to her and funds to her to support the family. I don't think at the end of the day this is a question of whether or not my client thinks his child deserves support. It's really more a question of public policy. I mean, he does not have the ability to modify or change this order because reentry into Costa Rica means he's going to be automatically jailed until such time as he pays the full arrears that they see fit. He's had no opportunity to defend himself, the opportunity to modify that order. Not only that, that particular child support order, it offends the public policy of the state. At this point, it's around
Let me pause you for a moment. Judge Hardy expressly found service was good on your client with respect to the 2005 support order, correct?
That is correct.
And arrearages started to accrue at that point, correct?
That would be correct, according to Costa Rica.
And he made no payments from 2005 until the 2007 divorce in Costa Rica occurred, or did he?
Your Honor, I may be confusing you. He has been, since they went back to Costa Rica, he's been sending money down there for the support of that child.
And but not the amount specified in the support order?
That's correct, not the amount specified.
So there are arrearages even from 2005 to 2007 under that support order, correct?
Under that support order, there would be.
And did Judge Hardy at least award those arrearages to Mr. Cornell's client?
He did not, and in part because...
And how do you defend that?
I defend that because we believe that the finding that that service was valid is wrong. We don't believe that service was valid.
Do you have any other defense to that piece of this case?
Well, the other question is whether or not that order folded into the secondary.
But even if it did, is there anything to say that it would have eclipsed the arrearages?
There's nothing to say that, no. I mean, my client's biggest position on that is we don't believe he got actual notice. He didn't have an opportunity to defend himself. He didn't have an opportunity to modify that.
Wasn't it by his own choice, really?
Well, Your Honor, he wasn't on notice. And at the point that he realized there was an order, it was too late. Not only that, there is extrinsic fraud with that. And I think on that particular order, maybe there is a second defense to it in terms of this court has the right to not enforce it under case law if it offends public policy, and there's extrinsic fraud, and we would argue that they're both to be one of those orders.
Counsel, I thought that the argument was that it was unenforceable under 130 because Costa Rica is not a recognized state, the AG, and there are material differences between the two, between Costa Rica and Nevada in establishing child support.
There is that argument, but even under 130, that order, both those orders, still have to meet with the requirements of Hilton versus Goyette, which requires comity between the two nations, and that is also not there. There's been case law from other states that have indicated just even under UFSA, you also have to have comity, and that is missing because there's indications of extrinsic fraud. There's also indication that it violates public policy. But 130 also mentions the public policy and fraud provision as well.
Well, before we even get to the comity analysis, if a party brings a foreign judgment to Nevada for enforcement, whether it be for arrearages or for prospective enforcement, doesn't the analysis begin with Chapter 130?
I think when it comes to child support, it's a very good place to start, but I think you cannot overlook the Supreme Court holding in Hilton versus Goyette and other cases, which clearly say comity is there. I do think 130, because it mentions public policy and fraud, is somewhat consistent with the comity. Interestingly enough, NRS 130 requires reciprocity from the other state. And my research is showing that right now there is no reciprocity from Costa Rica for Nevada orders, which would also complicate this and tell us that we're under no requirement to enforce that order. I mean, 130 is very clear that if it offends public policy, it's probably not something that the state should enforce. And I think it does. I mean, as of today, it's 71% of his income. We've clearly enacted statutes which tell us that child support for someone with one child would be 18% or 25% with two. There's a presumptive maximum. And there's an idea that we're not going to bankrupt one spouse and put the other in the will. You know, the child support statutes here in Nevada also make clear that there's a rebuttable presumption that those percentages are sufficient for the child unless that presumption is unrebutted. In Costa Rica, the child not only would get that high of a percentage, they get Christmas bonuses, school tuition, school supplies. My client's required to support them until they're 25. That is above and beyond the public policy of the state. Not only that, the alimony awarded in Costa Rica really defies the policy and the law of the state. This is a 3-year marriage, and even under my reading of Bright v. Osborne, there is no way to make this a permanent alimony case. She's not disabled, She's healthy. She's able to work. She was left with a home that my client assisted her in rebuilding in Costa Rica at the end of the divorce. There is no reason for her to have a permanent alimony award. And certainly the award given under Costa Rica definitely gives a permanent alimony award, which is very inconsistent with the public policy of the state. It not only that, it's going to leave my client in poverty, and under the Costa Rican money there, the exchange system, will put her in significant wealth. Alimony was never designed to do anything more than put the parties as close to the same status as they had during the marriage. And in this case, the alimony is definitely against that public policy. We believe that this court should not enforce the court orders from Costa Rica as to alimony and support. We believe they offend the public policy of the state. We further believe that they offend my client's due process rights and that he wasn't on full notice. Sadly, as it...
Counsel, Mr. Cornell makes an argument that apart from Chapter 130, in cases in which a Nevada citizen is personally served in a foreign country, and assuming this court accepted the findings of fact established by the trial judge in this case that your client was personally served, what is your response to his argument that the court should examine and enforce the order under 125B140 or 125180 because of the presence of personal service?
I mean, I still think you're dealing with a foreign court order. I think you have to look to UFSA. I think it was designed, UFSA, purposely to make sure the states were enforcing each other's orders. And to me, in a lot of ways, it's sort of like looking at the Uniform Child Custody Act. You look to those things and making those decisions because your state has agreed to them. And I think that you have to look to 130, and that's where the enforcement lies, is underneath that provision. I still think no matter what you look to, this case has to meet those basic rules of due process and comity, no matter what, even underneath the statutes. So, in discussing the premarital agreement, we do believe that it also should be enforced and upheld. I do think that the court's position on that is supported by the facts and evidence. We certainly know in this state that we've outlined very specifically in NRS 123A.080 what is not enforceable. And that boils down to a failure to disclose, which no one disagrees. We seem to all agree that the assets were disclosed in this case. It boils down to, is the agreement unconscionable, and whether or not the parties knowingly and voluntarily signed it. The last two seem to be when Mrs. Alpizar takes issue. And probably the issue where I see coming up the most in this case is the lack of interpretation of the agreement on its face. I do think that there is case law indicating that a failure to interpret a prenuptial can be problematic. Although the cases cited in Mrs. Alpizar's brief, I would point to you, show examples of things making it more under duress than what we see here. And that includes the husband himself interpreting it, or the agreement being interpreted by family members at last minute from the other side. This is not what we have here. That agreement was sent to her, according to the lower court, in July. She was surrounded by individuals who could have interpreted before her, including an aunt and uncle who were bilingual, including the couple that introduced the parties, and then on the date that it was signed by Maria Faith Shaw, who was hired as independent counsel for her, and also bilingual. The best evidence is her signature, which actually appears on the document that it was interpreted and read to her, along with that of Ms. Faith Shaw, who also signed off on that agreement being read and interpreted to her. There is no duress in this case, although my client had advised her he wanted the premarital agreement. That alone is not sufficient to create duress. He told her that from the very beginning. It was something she was well aware of long before the parties actually got married or the premarital agreement was presented to her. They've also expressed concerns about whether or not Maria Faith Shaw was independent counsel. I believe the case law supports that it is. Cases from outside this jurisdiction have indicated that where an attorney represents both, they're clearly not independent. There have been other cases that have shown an attorney is still independent even if the sister-in-law works in the same law firm. Here, my client had clear separate counsel, Joe Dorn. Mrs. Alpizar, she had her own separate counsel, Maria Faith Shaw. Maria Faith Shaw did not do any legal work for my client on the prenuptial agreement, nor did she do any legal work for him until well after the party's marriage. I think she was independent, and there's nothing otherwise to indicate. Certainly, in this case, the client was in her home country. She was surrounded by friends and family. She could have asked questions. She could have asked for assistance or refused to sign it, none of which she did. This agreement only became problematic upon her getting a divorce and, in this case, proceeding in Nevada.
What standard of review should we apply to our review of the district court's finding that agreement was valid?
I believe that you should use the de novo review on that in particular, unless you're looking at the facts, and then it's going to be separate on that. You're going to look for clearly erroneous.
Yeah, I had the same question. Judge Hardy made a finding that it was not executed under duress. Would that be reviewed for substantial evidence or de novo?
I believe substantial evidence on that, Your Honor, because it is a finding of fact that he's made. He clearly was in a position to review the parties and their credibility. So we are asking that the prenuptial be upheld and that the child support and alimony not be enforced. Thank you.
Thank you both for the excellent briefs and oral arguments. I appreciate it. The case is being submitted and we're adjourned.